Hey Radioheads, this is producer Phil. You are about to hear a live recording of Feminist Frequency Radio, episode number 50, live from Geek Girl Com in Seattle. Just a few quick notes before we dive in. There's a short segment where Anita plays a video. So all you're going to hear is some strange music that Anita picked out, and she won't tell me where she got it. It's strange. When you hear it, just imagine that you're watching clips from Ghostbusters, What Men Want, Doctor Who, and Ocean's 8. It doesn't last that long, and you'll soon be back with Anita, Kara, and Ebony. Elsewhere in the show, Carolyn brought up some pop culture news involving Justin Bieber and a burrito. We've since learned that that was a hoax, so please, no letters. Moving on, you'll hear in the intro that Anita describes the show as episode number 30. I don't know why she said that. I kind of blame the music I mentioned earlier. Finally, I'd like to mention that you should stay tuned for the bonus episode, which features me and Anita in a bar talking about, well, if you're a backer of the podcast, you can find out what we're talking about. If you're not a backer, you can be. Just head over to d.rip/femfreak. And now, on with the show.
Feminist Frequency Radio at Geek Girl Con. This is episode 30, and I am your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my fellow geek girls, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Adams.
Hey.
Is that the first time we've ever used your real name on the podcast?
Maybe.
I think recently you said the artist formerly known as Ebony Astor.
Ebony has been using a pseudonym this whole time, but now you know who she is.
Whatever. Listen. There's a whole complicated but boring story behind it.
That's true.
But anyway, since the book came out and the book has my government name on it, we felt it was just time for me to be known as Ebony Adams on the podcast.
This is a nice
whatever.
Reveal in front of
Call
all
me
of
Linda
you.
Belcher.
All right, so this is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show is going to be a wide-ranging look at female heroes across TV and media, and specifically what happens when key characters or properties get a reboot along the gender axis. After we talk about some of our favorites or not-so-favorite leading ladies, we will finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Now on with the show. Hey.
Hi.
We're at Geek Girl Con.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
How excited are you all to be here? Yes. So I have been to every single Geek Girl Con since its beginning.
Wait, when did it start?
I don't know. When did this start? It was like 6 or 7 or 29.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It's been around,
Are
man.
There other people here who've been to every single Geek Girl Con? Go
yeah.
Ahead. Good. Nice. I love this convention. I love it, which is... you know, the fact that I chase people down and take their photos constantly is proof of that. But the energy at this convention and just the heart that's evident is so great. I have a good time every single year. Like, I've never had a bad experience, which is not something I can say about other conventions, because some attract just a lot of challenging folks, you know? But Geek Girl Con,
you know,
love it, love
what
it.
What I love about it is all of the families. Like, that,
yes.
There's not a lot of conventions that are, like, kid-friendly, that are also adult-friendly, and mm-hmm. that you can, like, this mix works really well, and all the cosplay. I'm like, can you borrow children to dress them in cute costumes? Mm-hmm. Like, is there, like, a service where I can do that?
Yo.
I really want to do that.
There are a million adorable ones, but have y'all seen that little Coraline?
So
right?
Cute.
And her parents are other mother and other father with the buttons. Y'all find that family, okay? Because they're adorable.
He's going to send
don't
like a...
tell them I sent them out. You sent you after them. But they are adorable.
All right. Carolyn.
Yo.
How about a little entertainment news?
Oh, I've got some fantastic entertainment news for you this week. All right. Well, Tuesday of this past week, Megyn Kelly made a few... comments. There was during a show on her morning show.
Please tell us what those comments were.
Well, during her morning show, there was a conversation about like inappropriate or you know, Halloween costumes, and Megyn Kelly thought that it was somehow appropriate or okay to say, like, You know, I always thought, you know, when I was growing up, apparently she's like 90 years old. Who knew? You know, when I was growing up, it was okay to wear like black. She said blackface or whiteface as long as you were like being somebody. And, you know, she went on to say like something along the lines of like Diana Ross. Who doesn't love Diana Ross? As if like there's all kinds of white people wearing blackface and just celebrating. I don't know.
Here's the thing. Like, yeah. I love when people are like, oh, it was fine back then, as if, like, the oppressive status quo was okay. Right? You're like, oh,
but also,
so many, all these white people thought it was okay.
Right.
And nobody was speaking up about it, which is also bullshit. But somehow that makes it, like...
Yeah, but just, also, Megyn Kelly is, what, in her late 40s or something? And I'm like, yo, where did you grow up that this was okay? Because it is mind-boggling to me that she has this, I am sure, entirely erroneous memory that of Halloween's past where people were just walking around her neighborhood in blackface and that was not a horror show, right? And she's like, everybody was fine with it. But yeah, the idea that like, if it is tagged specifically to a character, if you were trying to be Diana Ross, which is the other thing I was like, is that the most contemporary black example you could come up with? Yeah. But if it's tagged to a specific character, that's somehow, you know, negates the entire problematic context of this. Bonk, no.
So, yeah, and so although this seems to have already spelled the end of her morning show, the actual status of Megyn Kelly at NBC is not yet, I don't think, fully decided. Megyn Kelly herself has said she wants to do more like hard news politics, you know, stuff. But Andy Lack, the head of news at NBC, said at a town hall this week, you know, there's no other way to put this, but I condemn those remarks. There's no place on our air in this workplace for them. However, I saw a tweet from a Twitter account at Sal Strange that really summed up my feelings about NBC's relationship or responsibility in this really well, that I don't think a lot of people are acknowledging. And what that tweet says is, you know, Megyn Kelly didn't get fired by NBC for being racist. She was hired for being racist in the hope she'd bring over some of her Fox followers for ratings. Yep. She was fired for failing to translate her racist fan base into NBC advertising.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
We all knew who Megyn Kelly was from Fox before she even started at NBC. This is just, you know, like that... you know, this is totally consistent with a million things she said and done in the past at her, you know, previous.
Yeah, because you remember Megyn Kelly was also the one that was all upset about Black Santas. She has a real like racial holiday issue.
Yeah, yeah. She has said on Fox News like, Santa Claus is white, period.
Yeah.
So a lot of tweets after the blackface comments were like,
I don't know why I'm surprised.
The only person Megyn Kelly would be upset, you know, if you wore blackface to be is Santa Claus.
Right.
You know?
Wait, hold on. But she was saying that whiteface is okay. So what's her deal with Santa Claus being black?
Well, because Santa Claus is white, period.
Right. What a...
There is...
What a hypocrite.
Yeah.
No, she's just... Yeah. Whatever. But yeah, I absolutely agree that everyone knew.
Right.
The also whiteface? Shut
knew,
the fuck up.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. If it's not Donald Glover on Atlanta doing that weirdo character, Teddy Perkins, whatever, I'm not into it. And even then, I'm a little bit whatever. But yeah, like everybody knew who she was. And the whole point was they thought that was going to be. Like, she was going to bring in money and bring in, you know, the right kind of attention.
Absolutely.
Right? So, yeah.
Right.
But she's walking around with a $69
also, like,
million paycheck.
Million a year, like, contract. I mean, it's outrageous.
Yeah. And can I get that gig? Because I will say absolutely anything for $23 million a year.
So moving on, reports now indicate that Apu, the character on The Simpsons, is being written off of The Simpsons. This follows the documentary The Problem with Apu by comedian Hari Kondabolu that was put out last year about, you know, the problem with Apu and how stereotypical he is, how Hari himself and so many other kind of people of Indian descent grew up. You know, being mocked, being called Apu, and just, you know, why Apu is not great. But, you know, Hari and others actually who have raised critical, you know, conversations about Apu are not thrilled with this news. You know, Hari has said himself on Twitter, Sorry, well, I have the tweet here somewhere. Anyway, he's basically said himself, like, this is not what I wanted. Like, there are a lot of ways you can take Apu and do good things with him to challenge the legacy that this character has had. Like, you know, yeah, I mean, we have so little Indian representation as it is. Like, getting rid of the character is not the right answer moving forward.
Yeah, that's really disappointing. Yeah. And, like, I hope they don't kill him off.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to handle it, but yeah.
To be honest, and I wouldn't be surprised because the reaction from producers and from Matt Groening himself was so petulant after the documentary. And whenever people tried to involve them in this conversation, I don't have a lot of hope, unfortunately, that, you know, the fact that they're taking this option with that character.
We just don't want to deal with it response, as opposed to let's look critically at, like, how Apu may have, you know, what we may have done wrong with this character and try to address it. It's like this, the kind of petulant response of just, well, fine then, you know, if you think it's a problem, then fine, we just won't do it at all anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really childish. Mm-hmm. Okay, next, Red Dead Redemption 2.
What's that?
It's, you know, this little indie game studio, Rockstar. It's Rockstar's newest open world, multi-million dollar epic, you know, game that was released this past week to rapturous reviews. Leading in the days up to the release, there was a lot of talk on Twitter and in general about labor in games, and specifically the crunch and the exploitative nature of the crunch at Rockstar in particular, where, you know, devs have reportedly been pushed to work, you know, 100-hour weeks for, you know, kind of weeks or months on end in the build-up to the game's release. And what's especially troubling in the days since the release is now, there's a GamesIndustry.biz reports that the Hauser brothers, the two brothers who are the heads of Rockstar, are expected to receive $538 million in Red Dead royalties. And what we, you know...
And they're going to spread that out as bonuses across the entire team,
like, that's
right?
That's what we have to... There's not that I'm aware of, but that's exactly it. Like... what we have to acknowledge is, like, oh, hey, you know, that's like the unpaid wages of all of the, you know, the game. I have played the first few hours of the game. It is like the detail, the craft, it's extraordinary. And you can tell it is the product of like an incalculable amount of human hours of labor. And like those people deserve a very significant share of the wealth that the game is going to generate because their labor made the game, but it doesn't seem likely that they are going to get anything remotely close to their to what they deserve for having been exploited in the process of making this game.
This is one of those, you know, the places that capitalism puts us in, right? Because we acknowledge that these workers are being exploited, and so we say, what is the answer then? Do I not buy Red Dead Redemption? Because ultimately, the company is only going to respond to certain kinds of pressure, right? And the most effective kind of pressure is going to be in their wallets, in financial pressure.
But you know that I don't believe in boycott.
That's the whole,
right, but that's the thing, is that, you know, we know that if we do boycott or we do put a hurt on the company financially, the rank and file are the ones who are going to suffer the most, right? I don't have an answer, by the way, if you were hoping I was going to pull something out of my back pocket. I don't know what we do, but this is the place that capitalism puts us in because, you know, we can sort of rise up and engage in whatever level of slacktivism, you know, we feel is appropriate for our individual causes. But ultimately, what is it going to take for these companies to change? They can, you know, apologize, they can issue press releases, et cetera. But at the end of the day, if they're getting $538 million in royalties, what incentive do they have to change?
Yeah.
Again, give me that job. I will also exploit people for $538 million.
Oh, all right.
Apparently, you know? Ebony's looking for work.
I'm telling you, doesn't it feel like, you know, people doing the worst are getting the most?
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
There is no ethical...
I can be bought. I have a price. It's pretty low.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
All right.
$538 million.
Well,
pretty
I would
low.
Go for much lower than that. I'm taking offers. I'll be here all weekend.
Finally, the most important entertainment story of the week. Justin Bieber.
Thank God. I was wondering when you were going to get to this.
Anita, I need you to explain this
sure,
to me.
Sure, sure.
Why is Justin Bieber eating a burrito sideways? What is happening there?
Because that's how Canadians eat burritos.
Okay.
For real.
Someone from the audience said, really?
I mean, I'm generally against, like, military action and stuff, but, I mean, I do have, like all of us, I have my limits. I mean, have we considered invading Canada over this? I mean, this is unacceptable.
As a Canadian, speaking for all Canadians, can we just deport Justin Bieber?
Oh, well.
To Canada?
For these notorious actions.
These heinous acts.
Okay, but for real, is this a joke? Well, or is he really? Is this like a real shot of him eating a burrito this way?
Because
it's super weird. Not to be judgy about how people eat.
No, we are.
Let's judge. Okay, here's my question. It looks like he was trying to get like, you know how you get your Chipotle burrito or whatever, and you're like, oh, the chicken's all in one.
Yeah, maybe it's
whatever.
Like,
you know,
the sour cream is in a pocket, like right there. So, I'm just going to go straight for the sour cream.
But wouldn't it be the same problem? Because the burrito is filled vertically, so then you're still going to have the same like
singular bite on the side. I'm just saying, it looks like he's trying to get some particular thing out of his burrito. And I'm like, why didn't you just get a burrito bowl?
Has he issued a press statement about this yet?
I mean,
tweet him.
Get on it, Justin.
Hit him up.
All right.
Slide into his DMs. He looks sad as hell right there, too, eating that burrito. Poor Justin.
Yeah, well, I don't feel bad. Maybe you can work for him and his
millions
of dollars.
I'm going to make it my freak out. I'm going to bring this back up at the end of the show.
Oh, boy. All right. Let's get on to the main so that we can get back to Justin Bieber, apparently, later. All right, so what we wanted to do for today is we were thinking of, you know, we've been talking a lot about all these like gender swapped reboots, right? So Ghostbusters and Ocean's 8 and this sort of like the trend to change the genders of classic films and TV shows and that sort of thing. And so I think that there's a lot here. You know, it's been happening more and more, and it's a trend that I think is a little bit complicated. Mm. So we were going to just chat about that a little bit. This morning, very quickly, I made a video, so apologies on how bad it is. Just leaned over and said, what music is this?
What the hell was that music? But, however, I do have to say,
I told you I did it this morning in like 5 minutes.
But no video in which we see Kate McKinnon winking suggestively can be all bad. So kudos.
Oh, yeah.
Kudos to you on that.
Yes,
that was
absolutely.
I approve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
How do we want to start this conversation?
Well, one person, I might have missed it, but was Starbuck?
No, okay. I didn't put BSG in it.
Okay, because I definitely want to, if we can, incorporate Battlestar Galactica. Do we have Battlestar Galactica fans in here? Right on. Because I think that there's something very interesting going on with the gender-swapped version of Starbuck, right, in Battlestar Galactica. And one of the things that I'm most interested in is that I came to the show later than most people. I didn't watch it when it was actually airing. So it was, you know, after lots of the concurrent fan conversation was going on. But nevertheless, it seemed as if even when the show was airing, there was a lot of love pretty immediately for Starbuck in a way that I don't think often happens or doesn't happen nearly enough when we gender swap a character, you know, a beloved character, right? And I wanted to kind of talk about why people think that might be. I think part of it is that she's part of a specific mold of like the badass, kick-ass warrior woman. And I think in pop cultural terms, there's a love for that kind of character. So I think that's partly it. But is it also partly that Battlestar Galactica, God bless it, the original version was somewhat of a cult property? So, I mean, is that...
Yeah. I mean, so, okay.
Sorry, I don't need to be turning my back to you.
No, it's fine.
The reboot happened in 2003, if I remember. There was a two-part miniseries, and then it got a whole series. And it actually, fun fact, became popularized as a cult hit through BitTorrenting, but that's a whole other issue and of interestical history of pop culture. Anyways, yeah, I don't remember there being as strong of a backlash against it. I also agree that I think the original BSG was kind of small potatoes in a lot of ways. Like, there wasn't, it was a revival, but it wasn't like this huge fandom. It's not like Star Wars, right? And I think that there's a big difference in, we didn't really have social media like we do today. And so a lot of the uproarious backlash that we see today against the sort of rise of men and boys freaking out about women speaking about pop culture issues, about these reboots, about having any kind of sort of progressive messages in our media, wasn't, there weren't as the same pockets of communities as visible and as engaged at the time. So even if there was a furor about it, they didn't have as much access to the public as they do today. So yeah, I don't remember it being as big of an issue. And Starbuck is such, like, Katie Sackhoff's Starbuck is such a beloved character. Do you remember it differently?
No, not at all.
Did you watch it?
Yeah. And I was a huge fan of...
So, and I had issue. Like, so I watched it. I watched the entire show in, like, 4 days. It was miserable.
Was it like that Portlandia sketch?
I don't know the Portlandia sketch.
Oh, God. This is what doing every episode with Anita is like, where I'm just like, you don't know what I'm talking about. No, whenever I make some sort of reference. Yeah, exactly.
But this time I was writing... a few years later, I was writing my master's thesis, and I wrote it about female characters in science fiction and the idea of the strong female character, because I found it really troubling that we were reproducing sort of patriarchal values of masculinity in feminized bodies. And Starbuck was a huge part of my thesis because she was all of the things, right? She was stoic and violent and aggressive, and like we tend to gravitate towards that just as we do with male heroes. Even though, like, viscerally, I'm still drawn to the character, even though I know that it's kind of I don't want to say problematic because that doesn't mean anything anymore, but it's kind it's almost simplistic in it's in the way that she's being portrayed. Even though I think Katie Sackhoff does a really good job of it. And so what is the difference now with things like Ghostbusters and, you know, like, and Ocean's 8, and it's becoming a genre of its own.
You know, even before these things come out, far in advance of the release, right? You have these mobilized online mobs who are like, nope, I want no part of it. No one gets to have any part of this. This is inappropriate. It's wrong. We're going to activate, you know, the harassers to make sure that everything gets, you know, one-star reviews. If there's anything we can do to make sure that, you know, this actually doesn't get released. Like, before they even have a chance, the simple fact of the gender swapping is itself problematic for certain properties. And I mean, and we saw this with Ghostbusters, and it was mind-blowing how just, you know, so the conversation was just, oh, there might be a gender swap version of Ghostbusters. We didn't know yet what it was going to be, whether it was going to be actual, like, you know, literal gender swapping of the characters we knew before, or if it was going to be new characters. And then finding out that the script had been written, it had been greenlit. But from the very beginning, this online mob was having no part of it.
Well,
you know,
and what's frustrating to, well, I mean, everything is frustrating, but one thing that's particularly, I don't know, that I find difficult to deal with is, so, you know, a film like Ghostbusters, the 2016, like, is, you know, that while there are things about it I really liked, I loved the character played by Kate McKinnon and stuff. Like, in a lot of ways, that movie did not give me what I wanted from a Ghostbusters film, is even though when I was a kid and I was a Ghostbusters fan, like, I imagined myself as, like, a female Ghostbuster, like, so I have, like, I want a great, so I guess what I'm saying is, like, these mobs and stuff can have a chilling effect on the conversations more generally, because it's almost like I feel like I can't say at times, like, well, you know, I didn't like this about it or that about it, because then I feel like I'm playing into, like, we can't just have a conversation about whether it's a good movie or not without, like, feeling like we're contributing to this attitude, when it's like, no, I mean, of course maybe even if I didn't think the movie was particularly good, it's not at all because it was a, you know, female-led Ghostbusters film, but can I even say that? And, you know, like, that's frustrating, too, is the way that even when you know, is that they cast such a shadow that it can have, I think, again, just a chilling effect on the conversations we can even have about the movie once it exists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the things, so I threw in What Men Want in this, which is coming out in 2019, and it's a remake of What Women Want that starred, what's his...
Mel Gibson.
Yeah. That horrible, horrible person. And that movie was deeply, deeply sexist. Right? And so...
What? Are you... I'm surprised by this. So, and it starred Mel Gibson, you say? And it was problematic?
Yes. We can watch it together if you want.
Why would we do that to ourselves?
So the thing is that, like, on a... I think it is really troubling that I think what is happening here is that you can take these properties that had sexist characterizations, right? Even in some of the ones that we're talking about, like Ghostbusters was not a beacon of progressive politics by any means, right? And if you swap the gender, it makes it okay for women to exhibit these behaviors that would not be acceptable for men to exhibit today. Mm-hmm. So like having all of a sudden there's going to be all of these sort of stereotypes about men, not that I feel bad for men or anything, but there's going to be all of these, there's going to be all these stereotypes about men and what masculinity is and what femininity is, and these very restrictive notions of these things are going to be perpetuated, but it stars a black woman, so therefore somehow that's going to make it okay. And I think that swapping women into men's roles, because that is what's happening here, is a way to soften mm-hmm. and like make these movies more woke, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. To be like, oh, we're just going to like change the sexism, or we can like erase the sexism because we're adding women into these roles, as opposed to,
yeah, but,
you right, know, but they're still fulfilling.
The core comedy, like the core joke of, well, I mean, I saw the trailer for it and it's horrifying. You know, the core comedy of What Women Want is completely rooted in What Women Want, right? It's completely the upcoming film.
What Men Want is the new one.
Oh, of course. Sorry.
Yeah.
What Men Want is completely rooted in these like very rigid stereotypical notions of gender, right? So this
is like, there's a couple things happening. One, it's a cash grab because Hollywood is so into rebooting everything under the sun, and this is like a fresh way to do it, so to speak. But what is the cost of like women's roles and women's opportunities if they're only getting to play these characters that, like, I think there's a real limitation here that isn't really part of the conversation because we're having these individual one-off conversations about each property, right?
And if, yeah, the only way we can imagine women getting more central, roles in stories, becoming more prominent in film is to have them be centered in stories that were traditionally about men rather than like creating, you know, new stories around that, around original new, you know, female characters. I mean, it's very, in a way, it's that thing of, I mean, it just kind of circles back to, it keeps patriarchy centered because, oh, sure, it's a woman, but really it's just this repetition of this previous story that came from this very kind of male, you know, perspective.
Yeah. The original What Women Want, the central conceit of it, such as it was that women are these unknowable creatures, right? That, you know, we are so mysterious and perhaps we don't even really know what we want. Like, that was kind of the heart of the joke and what, you know, was the structure of it, right? But are we confused about what men want? Is there a version of reality in which we aren't constantly dealing with what men want? You know? So, like, I just don't get it. Like, who asked for this? Yeah. Nobody. People who watch CBS ask for that.
There is a really good article, I think it's in the New York Times, by Amanda Hess on this topic. And if I can, I just want to read a little quote from it. She writes, "These reboots require women to relive men's stories instead of fashioning their own. And they're subtly expected to fix these old films to neutralize their sexism and infuse them with feminism to rebuild them into good movies with good politics, too. They have to do everything the men did, except backwards and with ideals."
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I really, and I recommend reading the article. It's quite good. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, someone save me. We start there.
But then, I remember.
Go for it.
No, you're probably going to say
no. I was just going to say, you know, but then we get things like Ocean's 8, which I have not seen, right?
Just about to bring up Ocean's 8.
Boom, this is what happens when you work together.
Yeah.
Yeah, two peas in a bucket. But like...
Ew. Ocean's, is the bucket dry?
I just have so hard of a time with you often. Anyways, yeah, so I just wanted to bring up Ocean's 8 because like Ghostbusters, at least, and it is the least we're getting, but at least what we're getting is... more than one woman. It's not the new problem of, oh, okay, so we're going to gender swap a character, but they will in fact be kind of the outlier, you know, like they will be in essence kind of the final girl, the beginning girl, the middle girl, but they will be the only one. And the reason why we're getting, you know, any introduction to them is because there's so much light, unlike other women. But I have not seen Ocean's 8. I know you loved it.
You haven't seen it?
Didn't we I watched it on the Scandinavian podcast? Crime drama. That's it.
Wait, were you not on that episode?
I was not.
Who was on that episode with us?
Did
we not do an episode?
I don't know.
We
did.
Yeah.
No, you did.
I don't remember. Maybe I don't have a remember.
This is really great content, y'all. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was about to say, like, I loved Ocean's 8. I watched it again this week. I love a good heist movie, and like an all-female cast makes me so happy. But like, you know, they're stealing jewels at a gala where all of these other heists get to be like taking over from crime bosses and casinos, and like they're sort of these big institutional things. And like, I like the movie. I enjoy it. But if we're going to get down to like what that means, you know, like they integrated... I was just thinking about how they do these gender swaps, right? So in Ocean's 11, which is also a remake in and of itself, they have Julia Roberts' character, who is like the love interest. In Ocean's 8, they have Sandra Bullock's dude who, spoilers, whatever, things happen to. And
that is a terrible spoiler.
It wasn't a spoiler.
Yeah.
But then I'm also thinking about in Ghostbusters, how they swapped the... I'm getting to a point, I promise.
Janine, the secretary,
yes,
for...
Yes, with Chris Hemsworth.
Right.
But Janine doesn't get to do anything in the original, where Chris Hemsworth actually gets, like, a role. Like, he becomes... Like, that was something that really... Not bothered me, because I mean, it bothered me. Here's the problem, and the reason I'm sort of stumbling across a lot of this is because I'm enjoying these films. I actually am liking them. It is refreshing to me to see female casts get to do things typically reserved for men.
Like objectify people? Because that's what happens with Chris Hemsworth's character, right? With
yeah,
Chris
well, Hemsworth. I mean, it was kind of funny. But also not okay. Anyways, you made me lose my train of thought because I started thinking about Chris Hemsworth.
Oh, God.
God damn. But I think that there's something about, like, just doing a straight swap. Right? Like, you're just swapping the female characters for the male characters, and do they get to have depths? Do they get to have their own stories? Are they just as, you know, like, a lot of these movies are written by and directed by men, right? It's so
yeah.
Just because the swap is happening on with the actors, they're not happening with the cast. I mean, with the crew and,
the writers,
yeah.
The director. Yeah.
That was not the point I was going to make, but nice save, Anita, because I've been rambling for way too long.
Yeah, I mean, so with Ghostbusters, the recent Ghostbusters, and then Ocean's 8, it's not a literal gender swapping, right? Because these are new characters. So it's not as if we're getting, like, the female version of Egon or, you know, right. Whatever, right? But nevertheless, we are supposed to constantly have those earlier models in mind, right? This film would not work if we didn't have such love and fondness for the earlier version of Ghostbusters. Ocean's 8 would never have been created if it was these characters, but they were not somehow tied to the larger Ocean's universe. So in some sense, they do participate in this reboot / remake / you know, refried beans remix, you know, but yeah, I mean, I do want to point that out, particularly because we are going to get comments from people being like, those are not gender swaps.
I know. Well, I know that's my fault because I just rambled because life. Let's talk about Doctor Who.
Yeah. Now that we have like 2 minutes left.
We got five. So yeah, female doctor.
Okay.
You know, like,
I mean,
no,
okay.
But for real, so this is a part of this whole thing that's
yeah.
happening, right? So, like, a lot of times these are swapped with white women, first of all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, race is a secondary aspect of the gender swapping genre that's now happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a criticism, but I think that the Doctor Who one is a little bit different from some of these other gender swapping ones because of the long history of Doctor Who and the narrative and where the Doctor comes from.
Yeah, I mean, like,
all
the reboot is built into the show, right? Like,
exactly.
We know from the beginning that the character of the Doctor, the person of the Doctor, will in fact change every few years for us as an audience. And so regardless of how attached you may get to any individual Doctor.
Or their eyebrows.
Or their eyebrows, right? Or whatever. You know, going in, that person is going to change. And not just physically, but, you know, emotionally. Like, they will in essence be a new person, right? So there's, you can't go into Doctor Who being like, what? I didn't know that this was, that's part of who the Doctor is. So we're always kind of one step ahead in that sense. But yeah, I do think when you said, like, you know, it's not a criticism that, you know, when we gender swap, it tends to be for a white woman. No, that is a criticism I have. Like, I knew.
Did I say that's not a criticism? Sorry.
Yeah, like, we knew.
That is a problem.
If the Doctor ever is a black woman, first, again, I am free. But if it will be so far in the future of an alternate universe, I can't even imagine how many heads would spontaneously explode if they revealed that, like, Naomi Harris was going to be, or Kirby Hal-Batiste. That girl needs to call me, by the way, because I feel like we would be friends. But seriously, like, you know, it was a hard step, and yet it was such an easy step. In a way, you know, for them to make this change. And I do think that for people who are upset at the change, there's a strong faction of the people who will always be upset at these kind of progressive choices, right? But the fact that the Doctor is still white is very important. Like, I was not surprised that we got a female Doctor before we got a Doctor of color.
Well, I feel like it does seem to me like if characters are kind of swapped, it's like we can swap them maybe along the axis of race or the axis of gender, but not both yet. It's we can do, because, you know, there's like two, their gender and their race are both essential, you know, and therefore, like, to swap both would be too much, you know.
Yeah.
It's like Jane, and it's just so weird to me the way, like, James Bond has been played by, like, seven different actors or however many, but you suggest that he could be sort of reimagined as a black man, and people flip out.
Piers Morgan?
I mean, Link in the Legend of Zelda games is not one character. Link is, like, multiple characters across multiple timelines, who's this sort of just, you know, a hero of the ages who kind of is embodied in different bodies over time, and yet to some people he's like, no, but Link is a man. Like, that's just part of, like, a core to who Link is. And it's like, Link doesn't even say anything in a game. Like, what? Like, how is Link, like, definitively a man? Like, what does that even... Anyway.
I was just going to say, you bring up a good point, though, about James Bond, because I don't want James Bond to be a person of color. I don't want that bullshit coming out. I'm being so serious here. Like, that throwback imperialist misogynist bullshit. Like, I don't want to see Idris Elba doing that. I don't want to, like, you know, I have enjoyed James Bond films in the past, you know, but we're good. I guess what I'm saying is my community, we're good.
So one of the things, too, that was pointed out about the gender swap is that the villains in these movies are all still men. Women don't get the opportunity to play male villains in these spaces as well. So, like, in the original movies, it's men fighting men, and now it's women fighting men. And so, like, I would like to see more opportunities for women villains as well in these spaces. Like, that would be, it almost feels like that's a step too far, right? Like, women still have to be, you know, so in Ocean's 8, it's the ex-boyfriend.
Right.
In Ghostbusters, it's the dude, whoever.
The dude who sort of embodies it to some... I mean, that's one thing I kind of liked about the movie, is that the villain, to some degree, embodies, like, the very people who were, you know, flipping out about the gender swap in the first place. Like, that was kind of cool.
Fair.
Yeah.
But still...
But I think, not to take away from your point, but yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, book plug... We talk in our book, History Versus Women.
Which you can buy upstairs.
Oh, it's the smoothest plug. But about how we don't quite know what to do with female villains yet, right?
No.
We don't. There are examples that we can point to across different media properties, but by and large, we don't have the cultural imagination or space for female villains in the way that we do for male villains. So you think about the kind of love we have for characters like Darth Vader or Loki or whatever, right? Well, Loki's kind of problematic because he's not... Okay, so there's a lot of gender stuff going on with Loki. Let's talk about that at another podcast. But you see what I'm saying, right? Like, this idea of this, like, very compelling, captivating, villainous figure... we don't quite have those same kind of models for female villains.
Occasionally, like Kate Blanchett in the Thor, the
yeah, but she still has to be sexualized.
She does. She was like, very sexualized.
I was just thinking about that with video games, of like female villains in video games are a disaster still. Mm-hmm. And like when they do exist, they are super sexualized or like queer coded in negative ways, or you know what I mean? Like we still.
Every once in a while you get one. Like I feel like what, Uncharted 3 had one. Like she wasn't even developed enough, but she was sort of like, oh, you know, I could see like Helen Mirren playing her if this was a movie.
Uncharted
like
4
older...
too.
Which one?
Do you mean Uncharted 4?
No, I meant Uncharted 3. I don't remember who the villain was in Uncharted 4.
I don't remember her name.
Anyways,
but yeah, I think that there needs to be more space for female villains. So like, let's gender swap some villains.
Sure. Or create new.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or create totally new villains.
Yeah, let's write some original shit.
That's hey.
Yeah.
There you go. All
right. If you take anything out of this panel...
It's
write some original shit.
Mm-hmm.
I should stop saying that because that's not
PG-13
language. I think shit is PG-13. Sorry.
I feel like,
so I'm just going to keep saying S-H-I-T.
What PG-13 is now is different, I think, than what used to be.
I think you're allowed
PG-13.
To say like the F word once.
Once.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
and
I've already said it,
it.
Five
oh,
times. I said it once for sure.
Okay.
All right.
Whatever.
Okay.
All right. Let's do some freakouts.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Now it's time for What's Your Freakout? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. So, as I mentioned earlier, Red Dead Redemption 2 came out. I streamed the first, like, 3 hours of it or so the night it came out on our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/femfreak. Follow us there and join me for various live streams of various video games. But, and, you know, it was, I just, this is not like a yay freak out or a boo freak out. It's a, like, I'm wrestling with this thing kind of freak out of... There were times, so I'm still very early in the game, obviously. This is not a judgment on the game as a finished product. I have a very open mind about wherever it may go, whatever it may do. But in that initial, say, few hours of the game, you know, there was this period of time, say, where, you know, the player character, Arthur, is, like, on a long stagecoach ride, and another character in his gang is kind of talking a lot about how like, you know, what a raw deal the, you know, the Native American peoples of this particular region that you're traveling through got from the government. And, you know, it comes across very much as the game trying to let you know, like, we are, like, the game is staunchly against, like, what the U.S. government did to, you know, Native, like, we're on the side of the people who were massacred, you know, we're against the U.S. government's actions during that period of time. And I mean, I felt this tension because it's like, well, of course I agree politically with this sentiment, but I also feel like the game is kind of shoehorning it in this, like, awkward way. So I was just torn because I'm like, on one hand, well, I'm thinking, like, isn't this what I want in games? Is I want, like, these kinds of ideas expressed by the characters, or I want games to make it clear to anyone playing them that, like, it takes this position and not that position, and yet I wasn't thrilled with the way this game was doing it.
Do you feel like it's like it just because? Do you feel like it was the way it was written? Like, if it had been a little more authentic, or not authentic but organic, like if it flowed better, or do you think it's just?
I think so. Like, I feel like maybe it just felt like this kind of... Maybe it was that it felt like a kind of lore dump type... Only not lore, but essentially like a kind of awkward... Yeah, like, again, just dump of perspective, of game political perspective, rather than something that seemed to maybe emerge organically from a situation the characters were actually in that moment or something. Yeah, I guess maybe that's it. Like, I'm hoping that as I continue playing the game, that I'll be able to develop a clearer perspective as I spend more time with these characters, and maybe they either continue to have conversations that I feel are kind of these awkward sort of political statements that just kind of get dropped in the middle of situations, or I feel like the game evolves to a point where that stuff happens more naturally and organically. But, you know, it's just there's a little bit of tension inside me as a player of like, okay, well, I'm glad that the game is making it clear that it feels this way, I guess, but I'm also, like, not thrilled with how it's doing it. And, you know, it's just, yeah, it was a strange feeling for me to have as a player.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, Ebony. What are you freaking
you
out about?
You will both be absolutely blown away by the fact that
crime
I'm
dramas?
Freaking about a crime drama. And well, it's crime fiction. So it's relevant to this podcast because I just finished reading, I want to say the title is Career of Evil, which I believe is the third Robert Galbraith novel. Robert Galbraith, pseudonym for J.K. Rowling.
Oh, okay.
Right. No, right? Whatever. My library had the third one in stock, and so I read the third one.
Wait, you started at the third one?
The point of crime fiction, like
I'm
soap operas.
You so hard.
No, but like soap operas, they adhere to a generic formula, right? That's the point. And so, first of all, you are able. There's enough exposition given to you in each book that you can kind of figure out what's gone ahead. But you know, each book is a standalone.
Do you
whatever.
Like when you open like books or nonfiction books? Do you just like thumb through it and find the parts that you want to read?
With nonfiction books, sometimes yeah. There are parts that I'm looking for. You know,
I know it just bugs me. It's
okay, bye. So I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that info. Okay. So, anyways, I read this book. So this is J.K. Rowling writing as Robert Galbraith, right? So this
Wait,
book
why?
Series.
Oh, we talked about this because kids. It's not for kids.
Yeah, and so yeah, I think okay. You know, in terms of branding, she wanted to separate. You know,
but why'd she pick a dude name?
Work.
I'm sorry, I'm really not letting you. But like, why'd she pick a dude name?
This is one of the things that I want to talk about. Oh. I think the fact that it is crime fiction, right? And it is a certain kind of crime fiction. It's not the kind of book that like Gillian Flynn wrote, like Gone Girl, right? But it's a much more traditional kind of crime fiction series. So the main character is this I think it's Cormoran Strike. He is a disabled vet. He is a private detective. He has a Girl Friday / assistant / in this third book partner, or sets partner in this book. The book I haven't read in the other ones. I just read the third one. It was extraordinarily well written and engaging. And yet it was so horrifying to me because the entire time I was reading it, I was thinking, why is J.K. Rowling, like, the fact that she chose a pseudonym, I understand, right? But the fact that she chose a masculine pseudonym for this particular genre and then wrote this particular book. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going in, and I love the fact that we have a disabled hero in this series. But, again, why is it that she chose to write a male hero of the model that we've seen so many times before? He is exactly what you would expect, the kind of, you know, tortured, hard drinking, you know, wry humor, has a kind of tense relationship with the law enforcement authorities who nevertheless respect the fact that he can see things that they can't. He's got this, you know, kind of adoring, who doesn't quite know that she's adoring, female companion. So it was very interesting to me that when she, she didn't leave the world of Harry Potter behind, but, you know, started writing these other books, that this is what she chose to write. But also, the book is, and again, I only saw or only read this third book. It is tremendously sexist in a lot of ways, like tremendously sexist in the way that you expect from traditional crime fiction. And so I'm just like, what are you doing, J.K. Rowling? And the fact that you're writing it under a masculine pseudonym, like that's something that's interesting. Somebody freak out with me about this. Hit me up on Twitter because I really want to talk about this book, and I definitely want to read the next one. I ain't going back to the first two, like I ain't got that kind of time, but I want to know if it continues in this way. And I was horrified because I was so drawn in by the story, but at the same time I was like, you're doing absolutely nothing new here, and you have the talent and the imagination to do something new.
Does
Why
she?
Aren't you? I enjoyed this
book. Look, I love Harry Potter, but right. there ain't nothing new about it.
Right, but I think also, oh God, am I going to make it out of this room alive? I did not love the writing of Harry Potter. And I mean, and I am, you know, assessing it, I think, you know, within its genre, right? Like, I'm not asking it to be literary fiction of a very elevated, like, as YA, I love the world, most of the world. I love the imagination behind it. But in terms of the actual writing, you know, she was earlier in her career. We all, well, hopefully most of us get better, right? But I think it's Career of Evil. It is extraordinarily well written in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. It is very propulsive. It's got like a really great tone to it. But I don't know. There was some interesting stuff there. The fact that she was replicating all these kind of like old tropes, and then the fact that if you did not know that it was her pseudonym, you'd think it was some dude writing it. That's interesting. I'm freaking out.
So my freak out is also about a book that I read because it was what was available at the library, because all the books that I wanted to read weren't available. So I just was like, what's
next?
So did
you go through like knocking the other books you didn't want off the shelf?
I mean,
like,
digitally, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I read Artemis by Andy Weir, who is the guy who wrote The Martian, who you may have read or seen the movie of. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the movie. I had not read the book. I had heard the book was very good, and so I was like, well, this is available. I might as well read it. So The Martian, if you know, is based on about a white dude. The protagonist is a white dude. Artemis, the protagonist, is a woman named Jasmine Bashira, and she is a Muslim Arab woman. And so Andy Weir writes very technically and scientifically about, like, it's very, very detailed in hard science. So you have to be pretty geeky on that kind of thing to enjoy it, because he's going into great detail about, like, the things, like how you can live on the moon and why things are exploding and everything is on fire, which I find very interesting and enjoy. The problem I have, like, and I liked the story. It's sort of heisty. I'm really into heisty things. My problem with it is I could never forget that it was a man writing a female character. And I'm having a hard time actually articulating the, like, I'm still trying to work through the specifics of what that means, because it feels very essentialist to me to even say that in a lot of ways. But, like, it feels like a male fantasy of, like, a cool chick. Right? And that there's nothing specifically about her interests that I'd be like, oh, a woman can't be interested in those things. It's just the way that she was characterized, and the way that it was. Like, I was talking to a friend, and he's like, I'm forgetting the word. It was so well, how, like, the confidence that white men have, right? Mm. And that, like, that feels wrong on a woman. And it was, he said it funny, and nobody likes this, and I shouldn't have said it. Anyway,
confidence porn?
No, but that's what this genre is. But yeah. That, like, he was like, he was insinuating that it might feel weird to have a female character that is just so deeply confident in this way. But that's not exactly it. It's just the tone of it, right? It's kind of the Starbuck problem in some ways, right? Like, it just feels like what society wants, like, a really cool, smart chick to be. Like, he writes, like, 20 times that she has a flawless memory. And I'm like, okay, you couldn't stop. Like, we got it the first 10 times, right? Like, you know, she talks about sex in a way that, like, you know, feels very forced. Not that, like, she can't be sexually liberated, whatever that means, and not that she can't be all of the things that she wants to be sexually. It's just the tone of it. And I found it striking, I think, because I don't read a lot of male authors. And I was kind of excited about the premise. So, you know, I don't know. If anyone has read it and have thoughts about this, I'd love to hear about that. So, yeah. Anyways, all right. That was my freak out. That's our show. Thank you so much for joining us. We are not live, but we have a show every single Wednesday. You can find us on all of the podcatchers. We are called Feminist Frequency Radio. And if you want to support us, you can become a backer at d.rip/femfreak. You can find us at FemFreak on all the things.
Or if people want to talk to you about the character in the book, Artemis, where can they do that?
in the clouds. I'm like, do I really want to tell people to message me about Artemis on Twitter?
At Ebony Aster? Is that where they should reach you?
Yes. All no, right. okay, yeah. sorry. I am at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at Inner City Gallifrey.
Yeah. Can I visit you there?
Yeah.
Sweet. All right, y'all. Thank you for being a part of this disastrous podcast.
come to our signing and come see us at our booth. Yeah. We love you all. Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.